On Tuesday, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had a press conference. We brought you most of it yesterday. What follows is the remainder of that press conference.
AFP. Mr. Lavrov, thank you. This is FAP. I would like to go back to the Middle East. Regarding the recent statement by Mahmoud Abbas, he said he accused Israel of putting an end to the Oslo peace deal, and he called Trump's proposal on the Israeli-Palestinian agreement slap in the face of the century. You know, we've commented on this situation. Trump's announcement regarding moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And we commented even more on the detrimental effect and the risks regarding this dead end in the Palestinian-Israeli settlement. And we completely understand the emotions that Palestinians feel today. For years, step by step, they've been making unilateral concessions without getting anything in return. And like I said, they were ready for direct talks with Israel without any preconditions. And we were ready to receive them here in Russia, offer Russia as a platform for such talks. But so far, we haven't had such direct contacts without any preliminary conditions. And under current circumstances, I think chances of this happening are close to zero, which is sad. At the same time, we've been hearing for a few months that the United States was about to publish a big deal that would sort out all the problems and make everybody happy. We haven't seen such a document. We haven't seen or heard anything like that. Once again, the fact that the Palestinian problem remains unresolved is one of the biggest factors that help radicals recruit new members for their movements, future terrorists. My Israeli colleagues used to be offended with me for such statements, but all serious analysts understand the statistics for the region. At the same time, this should not discourage us. There should not be any breakdown in contacts between the two parties, and I really hope that soon we should be able to have consultations with our partners within the quartet. In addition to the United States, this includes the United Nations and the European Union. And we'll have a brainstorming session on what we should do next. We cannot allow the situation to drift in a spontaneous way. I hear that there are ideas in Palestine to dissolve the national administration, the national authority, and declare Palestine an occupied territory and leave the responsibility for the functioning of this territory, for all the systems, for the way people live there, put the entire responsibility on Israel. I hope that we are able to find a way out of the situation. Like I said, we'll have consultations with other partners in the quartet, including bilateral contacts with the United States. Question from Pakistan.
Good afternoon. In 2007, Russia and Pakistan had multiple contacts on fighting terrorism and anti-drug trafficking and on Afghanistan. What about 2018? What is to be expected?
Ну, собственно говоря, вы совершенно справедливо отметили активизацию нашего взаимодействия.
You're right, saying that we've stepped up our efforts fighting terrorism together. We are interested in confronting the terrorist threat, which includes Pakistan, Afghanistan, and spills over your border with Afghanistan. We want to see this threat neutralized, and our agreement to supply Pakistan with special equipment, including helicopters for anti-terrorist units, is another indication of how serious we are. In addition to that, we also have our interests in developing economic cooperation. Of course, Pakistan, just like India, became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization last year, which provides us with additional opportunities for working together in many different areas, because the SCO is a structure that, on the one hand, ensures a security in our region, including fighting new threats. And at the same time, this institution is intended to develop economic and humanitarian cooperation. So I think Russian-Pakistan ties will also benefit from that. Speaking of the SCO and fighting extremism, I would like to mention that there was an important document signed by the leaders of the SCO last year. I mean, the Convention on Fighting Extremism. This convention sets up a very important framework, including the principle that it is unacceptable to use terrorist and extremist groups in the interests of putting pressure on sovereign states. We see many examples of that, including Libya, when Gaddafi was ousted, and such attempts, we also observe them in Syria. So I think this was an important convention. India and Pakistan joined this convention. And in addition to SCO members, we see that other countries are interested in joining it because it's open. It's not limited to SCO members only.
Final question. Three final questions. I'm from Mega TV station, Greece. It's no secret that the US is setting up a helicopter airbase and an LNG port in the northern port of Alexandroupol. This is the site of possible natural gas hub on the border between Greece and Turkey. It is perceived as a symbolic attempt to block strategic or energy cooperation between Russia and the Balkans and Russia and Turkey and Russia and the south of Europe. Could this pressure by the US exacerbate Russian-Greek ties? And you might know that there are negotiations on our neighbor and the name of our neighbor's country, Macedonia. The Greeks hold a grudge against Macedonia because most of the land of that ancient country belongs to Greece, but sort of if our neighbor has a name like this, it sort of lays territorial claims to us. And, you know, there have been plans that Russia could have changed
its Russia said name. That we recognized Macedonia as the Republic of Macedonia.
But if conditions are changed, if there's a new compromise,
as far as gas is concerned, I've already mentioned that what the United States does is because it is afraid of fair competition, open competition, because they cannot compete with us. And that's why they use unfair competition, they use political pressure, they want to force European countries to build infrastructure and buy gas, natural gas from the United States at a higher price. But that's up to European countries to decide about that. They have to look after their economic interests. If they're willing to spend more, well, that's up to them. Our projects, diversifying gas delivery routes going to Europe, I mentioned Nord Stream 2 and the Turkish Stream, which can be extended to Europe. So far, it's just phase one for consumers in Turkey. Phase two will only be built if we get ironclad guarantees from the EU Commission that they will not do the same thing as they did with the South Stream pipeline and Bulgaria, which, by the way, is now willing to take phase two of the Turkish Stream. We would be open to any of those options, but as long as we get ironclad guarantees from the European Commission. Of course, we've been following the discussions in the European Commission because they want to bring in those new rules to slow down the Nord Stream project. It's a dirty trick, but I think that the economic nature of this project and support for it by leading energy companies in European countries will prevent those dirty plans from becoming reality. As regards talks or efforts on the name of Macedonia, these efforts have been somewhat dormant for a number of years, and they only became active when the United States decided to make Macedonia join NATO, since Greece is already a NATO member. You don't need concessions. It's Macedonia that needs concessions, which they want to make part of NATO. So, no matter what name you agree on, Greece and Macedonia for the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia, if an official decision is made, which is reflected in the Macedonian constitution, everybody would recognize that. But I think everybody understands what's the essence of the process that's going on. It's not about taking into account the specific nature of these two neighboring countries. The point is just making one of these two countries a NATO member.
Anton Zhilnov, Dozhte TV station. Last year, two Russian citizens, Grigory Tsurkano and Roman Zabolotny, were captured in Syria, and there was video evidence that they were Russian citizens. And our TV station talked to the relatives of one of the captured, and those his parents sent requests to every Russian official agency, but no one told them anything. Someone from the defense ministry said that possibly this data is classified, so formally they were not servicemen, and probably it was just like a private company that they were fighting for, they were working for. Could you please share anything on this? And could you also talk about any other Russian private companies that are fighting elsewhere?
I don't have anything to add to what you said. We are aware of the reports you mentioned. Whenever there is a Russian person, no matter which country they're in, if there is a report that the Russian person is missing or is in trouble, we work on that. You mentioned two Russian citizens. Their whereabouts are unknown. So, it is first and foremost our military that try to locate them. So, as soon as we have some information, we'll share it with you. As for other countries, yes, such practice does exist in many countries. This happened in Iraq and in other countries in the same region where the company Blackwater worked, and later its name was changed to something else. I think there is a need for a clear regulation for these people need to be protected legally.
This year, Japanese Prime Minister Abe will visit Russia, and you will go to Tokyo. We had a question from BBC, but what about you? Are you planning to visit Japan, and what is your mission? What possible agreements or documents will be signed? When will this meeting take place in Tokyo? Before the March election or after the presidential election? Just recently, we have encountered new problems. That's the deployment of the new system in Japan. It's the anti-missile defense, and they say that our Japanese authorities say that it's different from the one installed in Korea and the one installed in Europe, and it's Japan that controls this anti-missile system, that it's not part of the U.S. global anti-missile system. They also said that it's not possible to use Tomahawks in this system. What is Russia's response to it?
Good things first. Yes, we are looking forward to Prime Minister Abe's visit to Russia. We have an agreement for the foreign ministers to meet in the run-up to this visit. The date of the ministers' meeting will be determined later at a time that is good for both parties. As for our specific plans, the Prime Minister and the President will look into the implementation of the agreement on joint economic development of disputed territories. We have five areas that we focus on. It's a limited scale project, but we hope that we will add some other industries to this project, and deputy foreign ministers have been working on that. We are happy that the 2+2 talks have been resumed between the foreign ministers and the defense ministers. The chief of the Russian general staff, Mr. Gerasimov, visited Tokyo recently, and prior to that, commander of the army, General Salikhov, went there, and there was a meeting of the bilateral commission, and simultaneously, my colleague, Mr. Tarakonda, visited Moscow, and we had talks here. So now, we'll set a date for a new meeting, like I said. Economic cooperation, apart from joint economic development on the islands, has been going quite well. We have Japanese investors in Russia. Japanese banks provided a serious amount of money in loans for the Yamal LNG project. And this long-term investment adds stability to our cooperation. Humanitarian contacts, as always, have been strong. In addition to annual Russian Culture Festival, last year we had cultural seasons, and we are quite happy with what we've been doing in our interaction with Japan. We would like to coordinate closer on the international arena. We discussed this during our 2+2 meetings. And of course, we would like Japan to be more independent. When discussing key international issues in international organizations, the missile defense issue is a dark cloud in our relations. Let me be frank about that. We talked to our Japanese partners. They offered all those arguments. They said that this Aegis system that will be deployed in Japan is different from what South Korea has and what they have in Europe. We don't have this data. What the data we have indicates that the system to be deployed in Japan uses universal launchers, which can use strike missiles. We heard that supposedly Japan will control the system. The United States will not have any control over the system, but we still have our doubts about that. And as part of our security dialogue between the secretaries of the security councils of Russia and Japan, we would like to receive more substantial assurances on that. We are not aware of any cases anywhere around the globe where the United States would deploy its weapons and then would hand over control over those weapons to the host country. And I really doubt that the United States will make an exception in the case of Japan. But like I said, we are open to dialogue, and we would like to have a dialogue on missile defense, something that we suggested 11 years ago. We want to start this. We want all of us to see clearly that these missile defense systems. We have a number of questions on what the United States does in this regard. We don't want those systems to destabilize the international system. So far, our U.S. partners, just like under the Obama administration and the Bush administration before him, just tell us that those systems will not be used against us and we should not be worried. But we have lots of evidence showing that this is not true.
Estonian television. Estonian newspaper. Mr. Lavrov, in 2014, you signed an agreement on the border with Estonia and with your counterpart.
And the first reading on that document took place in 2015 by the Estonian Parliament. You know, there was an arrangement that the ratification process will take place in sync. Estonia have been waiting for 2 years for the first reading on that agreement at the Russian Parliament. And in 2015, there was a meeting, and you promised that Parliament will start its process soon. Soon is when?
Well, there is some background to this story. We first signed this treaty in 2005, and we made a commitment to ratify this treaty without any politicized caveats. Yet, the Estonian Parliament ratified this treaty and added to the ratification treaty a reference to the Tartu Agreement, which openly states that their territorial claims to Russia remain. This was a violation of the commitments made by my colleagues. So then we revoked our signature under this treaty, and we said, guys, when you reconsider your package of documents and when you remove this reference to the Tartu Agreement, we will be able to restart those talks and sign this treaty anew. Eventually, this happened, and we did sign this new treaty. And once again, we made an agreement that the process will be synchronized. You're right about that. But you mentioned the number one condition, and number one condition was that there will be non-confrontational atmosphere between the ruling elites in both countries. We maintained our part of the deal. We did not launch any attacks against Estonia, just like in the past. But the Estonian government did not show such restraint. On the contrary, their rhetoric was extremely Russophobic. And we said openly that our parliament, our people, would not understand us if we promote this treaty in such an environment. At the same time, I would like to assure you that the border is there and the treaty will sooner or later be ratified. Nobody questions this border. But for the treaty to go into effect and for us to go back to normal life, what you should do is stop being one of the three or four most active countries in the NATO and in the European Union promoting Russophobia. Like I said, we have very good relations with the people of Estonia. Our peoples are friends, and politicians should be guided by this, not by some short-term political goals reflecting geopolitical interests of other countries, but by the interests of their people. Thank you.
Next, this interview by Glenn Ford of Professor Tony Montero about the Dr. King holiday, W.E.B. Du Bois, and a lot more.
Dr. Martin Luther King's life and work has been institutionalized with commemorations of his birthday occurring this week in virtually every city and town in the nation. Dr. King's anti-war views are less celebrated by the powers that be. King called for a movement to oppose the triple evils of racism, militarism, and materialism, and indicted the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. We spoke with Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montero in Philadelphia.
On this Martin Luther King Day, I think it's apparent that Martin Luther King, the man that he was and the figure in history that he was, remains relevant precisely for the reason that you have put on the table. He stood up against imperialism and war and economic exploitation, be it in the United States or around the world. So King remains relevant. His message remains relevant. His life remains relevant. However, to bring his relevance forward requires a very tough ideological struggle against the neoliberal elite, including those in the Black misleadership class and the intelligentsia who dance to the tune of the neoliberals, be they in the Republican or Democratic Party. So looking forward, it was King who reminded us of the fierce urgency of now. Imperialism is in a crisis. Europe as a civilizational project, and I'm not just talking about continental Europe, I'm talking about the European world, or what we could call the white world, is in crisis. It is a civilizational crisis, which means that it is much deeper than its economic manifestations. What we're looking at is pretty much the collapse and unraveling of Europe and the irresistible rise of Asia and its necessary consort, Africa.
Well, how is this working out in actual terms in the world? The rise of Asia, usually folks are speaking about China when they speak that way.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a complicated process. Certainly, the present anchor of this rise is China. However, Chinese diplomats and politicians and their leadership realize that its rise cannot be sustained unless China is allied with other Asian countries and with Africa. For example, the strategic alliance between China and Russia, the moves towards détente between China and Vietnam, the movement of the Philippines closer to China. Hopefully in the future, we will see a détente between India and China. Certainly the new movements and developments between Pakistan and China, where trade between the two nations will take place in Yuan. A big part of this rise of Asia, and then I see the same logic occurring between Africa and Asia, is decoupling from the dollar. The dollar, which since 1971 has been the reserve currency, is not so strong these days. I would suggest that this movement towards cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and so on is an attempt to forestall the rise of other currencies such as the Chinese yuan, the Russian ruble, and so on.
Well, certainly the growing ties between Russia and China are dramatic, but Africa in resistance to U.S. Euro imperialism, that picture is much more murky. Where do you see Africa rising?
Well, and you're right, it is murky and it is difficult. The great problem that Africa faces is how will it achieve unity? And I mean substantive unity, not just unity in talk or formal unity. And to get there, they're going to have to find a way to overcome the partition of Africa, which in the 21st century has produced all of these pretty much mini states, 54 nations, and who knows how many more will come as imperialism gets involved in the affairs of nations and destabilizes them. You know, imperialism would like to see 100 African nations bickering and fighting and each nation's leadership prancing around at the UN as though they had some power. That's what imperialism wants. Now, to overcome that, I think, requires ultimately a number of states. I mean, a few states, no more than 10. You could call them federated states. For example, a West African Federation, a Central African Federation, a Northeast Africa and Horn of Africa Federation. And ultimately, these federated states would operate like single states. And finally, a African Union that is united in actuality, that is a single currency backed up by gold, a single foreign policy, a single military policy. And of course, this means a relinquishing of the little bit of power that each of these nations have for the good of the whole continent, which would mean creating a very, very powerful economy, a very, very powerful political entity in the world, which could then be a legitimate and reliable negotiating partner with the 1.5 billion people in China or the 1.3 or 4 billion people in India. Hence, the 1.5 billion Africans would bring their weight just in numbers, not to mention the economic potential, to the table of global affairs and ultimately the remaking of the world away from European civilization towards a human civilization anchored in the unity of Africa and Asia.
Well, that's a very hopeful prospect, and in particulars, it sounds very much like that which was pursued by the deposed and murdered former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. But the United States, through its AFRICOM, virtually militarily occupies Africa. And of those 54 independent nations on the continent, at least 53 are in some kind of agreement with the AFRICOM military organization. How does that scenario that you spoke of come to pass under the present kind of relationship?
We have to look at the United States in particular, the largest empire in human history, the most lethal military in human history. We must look at the United States as an empire in decline, which is part and parcel of the decline in what I'm calling the collapse of Europe. Certainly, Africa is very weak relative to the United States and the NATO powers, militarily and economically. However, the United States leadership is not united. There is a big fight over whether or not the United States can afford the cost of empire. All of these interventions and regime changes and threats of nuclear war against North Korea, threats of war and nuclear war against Russia. Well, you know, they're selling a lot of wolf tickets, and I don't think they could back it up because the internal contradictions at the level of the ruling elite are such that I don't believe they can strategically unite around anything. Now, on the other side, as imperfect as it is, we are witnessing new levels of unity to challenge the American empire and the American hegemonist.
You raised the question of whether the United States can afford the cost of empire, but how would the ruling elite in the United States maintain its position in the world without a military-based coercive empire?
Well, that's my point. It can't. And with all of the threats, there are contradictions in the United States that are deepening every day. Half of the American population is near poverty. One third of the American population is in officially defined poverty. The younger generation cannot imagine a future for itself under the existing arrangements of class and race. This is a country that is going to be forced to turn inward. And forms of what we could call civil war are not out of the question. An angry white population, which sees the decline of the power of whiteness and white privilege, who are dissatisfied with all of those leaders and spokesmen that got them to this point. I don't think these people are ready for war. Certainly not a war with a nation, let us say North Korea, that is technologically the equivalent of the United States, and in terms of its population, is more united and prepared for a protracted military struggle if it comes to that. The American people do not have that same spirit of, quote, defending American interests overseas. So I think the war makers and the military are up against some serious problems. Now, I know you're going to ask me, or I'm anticipating that you'll ask me, well, but white people will turn to racism rather than go up against the white elite. I think the white masses are severely and deeply divided. In fact, many will do as you could suggest. But I think there is a critical mass of them who have washed their hands of this, especially among young people of multiple political positions and class and ideological positions. The young are not going for this anymore.
Well, polls have shown that the American public is not in line with the two war parties, belligerents in international affairs. But where is the peace party?
Well, that's the problem. The problem for the masses is leadership. Who will lead? And I'm not talking about a single leader. I'm talking about a united people who are galvanized behind a set of very simple demands, such as universal health care, jobs, education, none of which can be achieved without taking down the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the military. I mean, if the ruling class cannot afford empire, certainly the people of this country can't afford empire. And at some point, questions of class and the well-being of ordinary people kind of trumps the whole whiteness, racist proclivity. That's not to say that these white people are going to give it up overnight, but it throws them into turmoil when their white identity conflicts with their class position, by which I mean the ever-descending process into poverty, unemployment, drug addiction, suicide, all of these social problems that manifest a society and, in fact, a civilization that is unraveling.
Well, you're addressing the political crisis in white America, but there certainly can be no peace party in the United States without the active participation of black America. And the black political establishment seems solidly aligned with the forces of militarism and racism and capitalism.
And that's their dilemma, because they're going to go down with the neoliberals, the Maxine Waters of the world, just to name one, will go down with them, and they know it. I could even mention the Oprah Winfreys of the world. They have no future because they have lost the trust and respect of Afro-America. And, you know, I think the best indicator of it all was Alabama. You know, we don't get the clearest representation of what went on there. We do know that 97% of black women voted against Roy Moore. We know that 94% of black men did. Now that, you know, people take that lightly. That is humongous and has deep historical meaning. Now, of course, it took place within the straitjacket of the two-party system. But black folks saw an opportunity, not just to defeat Roy Moore, but to say in no uncertain terms, we are voting for jobs, we are voting for schools, we're voting for health care, and that's it. I think it was an act in the main of profound political independence and bodes well for the future of black resistance. Now, the revolutionary and radical forces who should, if we are wise and if we are tactically sophisticated, can move to positions of real influence within the masses of our people in a way that we were kind of locked out during the years of Obama. And frankly, when you look at Alabama, it seems to me that the Obama time is over, that black folk, and especially the masses, are looking at their objective conditions of life, are assessing them, are thinking collectively, and acting in ways that no other part of the population does act. I think it's very, very positive going forward.
Near the end of Obama time, 2 years ago in Philadelphia, you were one of the organizers of an historic conference on the Black radical tradition. But how is that tradition faring under this new regime of Trump?
Well, I think it's faring quite well. I mean, Trump is not a single individual. I mean, Trump is a manifestation of something far deeper. And the kind of internal struggle that his election kicked off, basically a struggle to say you were elected, but you're not going to take power. That kind of struggle to prevent him from taking power has begun to show black folk what the nature of power, what the nature of class and race rule are in this country. I think this is all educational stuff for the masses. The black radical tradition provides important ways of looking at a situation like that, like this, because at the core of the black radical tradition is an understanding of the inevitable crisis. In fact, now the terminal crisis of American imperialism, that there will come a time, and they all thought, like be it Du Bois or Baldwin or C.L.R. James or Fannie Lou Hamer, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm, that at some point, the unity of white folk fractures. When white folk are disunited, black people have greater possibilities to unite and advance an agenda which is in the interest of the entire nation. I think that's what is coming forward at this time. I think we radicals have opportunities that we have not had in over 40 years to impact the direction of our people. We see a decline in the legitimacy and influence of the Al Sharptons, of the Congressional Black Caucus, of the Oprah Winfreys, if you will. But at the same time, we see the masses of people listening, attempting to hear what they only a few years ago would have thought was outlandish and unworthy of consideration.
You and like-minded activists in Philadelphia are going to spend much of the coming year celebrating the life and work of W.E.B. Du Bois. And how are his long, long life and deep political researches relevant to today?
Well, you know, this year is the 150th anniversary of his birth, which is an important occasion. And we are going to celebrate it here. Philadelphia is going to celebrate it. The city council is going to pass a resolution declaring this the year of W.E.B. Du Bois. And Philadelphia will read and study and think about Du Bois. Now, what is the significance of this? Let us never forget that the ruling elite of this country for over 40 years and even up till today have waged a ideological campaign to erase Du Bois from the thinking and ideology of the black community and progressive community, and to distort what he stood for and the meaning of his work. We intend to make a dent in that, to restore him as a central figure in the ideological struggle for black freedom in the United States and for the fight against colonialism and imperialism worldwide. Of course, when we begin to talk about Du Bois, that brings up every question that confronts the people today. For example, what is the nature of white supremacy? What is the nature of capitalism? What is the nature of colonialism? Why must the struggle of black people be internationalized, as Du Bois always argued? What type of pan-Africa do we need at this moment? What is the nature of the cultural and artistic and literary revolution that black America needs to galvanize us around art and how art shapes the character of a people? All of this was a part of the body of work that is W.E.B. Du Bois. And of course, as an example to young people and to black people, period, moral courage, principled politics. That doesn't mean you're always going to be right or everybody's going to agree upon anything. But putting the principle of resistance ahead of individual rewards, we're not talking about that. We're talking about something colossal, something global, something futuristic, something that thinks in terms of radical transformation of the world itself.
That was Dr. Anthony Matiro speaking from Philadelphia.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.